From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. On our interfaith calendar, Sunday marks the Hindu celebration of the birth of Krishna. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Europe has seen a rise in anti-Semitic attacks over the last few weeks, and America is not immune. Vandalism directed not towards Israeli institutions, but towards synagogues.
The negatives towards Arabs and Muslims continue to rise, and favorable attitudes decline. We're at the lowest point now that we've been since we began the polling.
I don't have to tell you, tensions are running high, very high, in a number of hotspots around the world. From Gaza to Iraq to Ukraine, we're seeing conflicts that are difficult to grasp and virtually impossible to diagnose. Certainly that is not something we're qualified to do here on State of Belief. But when faraway conflicts seem to find expression right here at home, especially when a faith component is involved, then that is something we most definitely need to look at. On this week's show, I'll talk with two leaders who are struggling with the negative impact of recent events overseas on members of their communities right here at home. Dr. James Zogby is president of the Arab American Institute. The Institute has just released a survey demonstrating that perception of Arab and Muslim Americans is headed in the wrong direction. I'll also talk with Rabbi Brad Hirschfeld, president of CLOW, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership, about what looks to be a recent surge in anti-Semitic incidents in this country. And then later in the show, I'll have just a few thoughts I want to share with you regarding the tragic suicide death of actor and comedian Robin Williams this past week at the age of 63. But first,
that's intimidation over there to me. And that's what this is about, intimidation. Why can't we fix it and make a dialogue instead of that happening? Why don't they come and walk with us?
How can we feel like we can have free speech if there's a guy staring down a sniper rifle as we speak?
This ain't about just Michael Brown no more. It's bigger than that.
Violence in the streets of our nation takes many forms. Last Saturday, in a suburb of St. Louis, Ferguson, Missouri, 18-year-old Michael Brown lost his life in a police shooting that is still under investigation. The outpouring of rage and grief on the part of Ferguson's African-American community was immediate and quickly polarized into solemn vigils, but also into some violent protests. Joining me to talk about the events in Ferguson this past week, as well as the work that his excellent organization is doing around some of the racial issues raised by this shooting, is Pastor Mike McBride. He leads Lifelines to Healing, part of the PICO network. Pastor Mike, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Great to be here with you again, Reverend, and everyone.
You've been out front, as we would expect you to be, suggesting that this level of conflict is an inevitable outcome of avoiding a conversation on race in this country that needs to happen. Mike, let's start right there, and you expand on that, if you will.
There are, as Dr. Martin Luther King says, two Americas. Well, there's one America that is beautiful for situations, flowing with resources and opportunity, and there's another America that does not experience the sunlight of opportunity, that is not beautiful, but rather very ugly and painful and destructive. And our inability as a country to have a constructive conversation about the reality of these two Americas still existing, I think is feeding a very negative underbelly of division that these kinds of tragic incidents, as frequently as they continue to happen, it is feeding a very sad and dangerous environment, all because we refuse to talk about the issues of race, the issues of class, and the ways in which the structures and the systems of our country.
What kind of culture develops in the absence of honest conversations about race?
So I will tell you from my own personal experience very concretely. I am growing up in a Christian household with both of my parents, never been arrested. I was a Bible college student in the city of San Jose. Driving home one night, two white police officers pulled me over and proceeded to physically and sexually assault me because they were threatened by my presence, my behavior, after they reached through my legs and grabbed my groin area. That kind of consistent racial profiling, stop and frisk, these kind of consistent encounters that many, overwhelmingly majority number of African-American, particularly men, have every single day, reaches a boiling point. It reaches a place of such high frustration, but not frustration and solely anger, but fear. And what I think what people who have never been physically detained or assaulted by the police will never understand is the dehumanization one feels before, during, and after such an encounter. While it may not make sense for folks to respond in these incidents with such rage and potentially belligerent behavior, it's because many people are getting back in touch with a kind of pain and violation, and they never had an opportunity to say it was wrong because the law enforcement person or the security person or whoever has been able to get off and go on about their business every day, and we've been left with that experience. The inability for us to at least acknowledge that as an experience that people are facing every single day, to acknowledge that that is a racialized experience, to acknowledge that the response in Ferguson versus the response with the Bundy ranchers in Arizona or the western part of the country are deeply racialized, to not be able to acknowledge that and understand what that is about, is fueling, I believe, a very dangerous chasm of experience and understanding in our country. And people of faith have to lead this conversation. We have to step and lean into it because we are equipped, I believe, with a higher calling and a higher mandate to see one another beyond these stereotypes, beyond these racialized barriers. But we have to do it by engaging with one another. And our country is dropping the ball, I believe, from the federal government all the way down.
Doesn't this culture also point to a very dangerous assumption that anybody in this nation could be treated like you just described you were treated and get away with it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was a recent report in New York of a mother who was breastfeeding her daughter. And police, because she did not move fast enough or comply with his command, actually manhandled her in a way where her newborn baby fell to the ground from nursing on her breast, fell to the ground, and the baby died. And I believe this was a Caucasian woman, right? This kind of aggressive over-policing that is happening in our country is a serious problem. And I speak on this as someone who is actively engaged with the Department of Justice, with a number of national network for safe communities, police chief organizations. We're working on police legitimacy. We're working on repairing the harm that has happened historically between communities and law enforcement. I speak on this as someone who is actively involved in trying to strengthen police-community relationships. We need to make sure that law enforcement do not overreach. Right now, they're using military-style weapons and bringing those into our communities. The Department of Justice and the federal government, I think Homeland Security and others, are incentivizing and giving free weapons, tanks, and things to police agencies. This should not be present on the street of our cities. And part of the reason why this is happening, I remember after I was beat up by the police in 1999, we were having lots of conversations about this very thing. And 9/11 happened in 2001. I'm telling you, Dr. Gaddy, that before 9/11 happened, there was a massive move to address racial profiling, put cameras on police officers. There was all this movement, and 9/11 happened, and fear was introduced into our country's psyche in such a way where police and law enforcement pretty much have received a blank check since then, and now we have a militarized police force in our communities. It is not acceptable, and all of us should be concerned about it, not because we're anarchists or anti-government. It's because we are citizens of the United States of America. It's our tax dollars. We determine how law enforcement should be engaging our communities and not the other way around.
I'm quite sure that you have been on the phone with people in Ferguson. What are you hearing from people in Ferguson, and what are you saying to those people?
We talked to a number of clergy, a number of young people. They've gotten on some of our national calls. They are afraid. Many of them said that they have never seen this amount of artillery. They're expressing how the tear gas and the rubber bullets are going through people's homes and knives that aren't even involved in any of the nonviolent protests that are happening outside. They acknowledge that there are a few folks out there who are resorting to violence, but they feel like they are being provoked by these weapons and tear gas thrown at their feet. They are asking us to come and help support them in doing some faith-based and nonviolent organizing. So we are preparing ourselves to go there and support them. There's a effort that we've already gotten over 100 congregations to join us this Sunday and Saturday on a Live Free Sabbath, where we're going to preach, pray, and act to try and help raise the awareness in our congregations to support what's happening there, but also reach out in our own communities. They're trying to figure out what can we do that's constructive. What can we do that can actually harness the energy and frustration of our city, but not burn the city to the ground, not cause us to not get the change that we want. There's a lot of pain in Ferguson right now, but there's a lot of courage and there's a lot of commitment to stay involved and to stay engaged. They're talking about registering people to vote, which is a amazing even thought to have young people saying we all need to get registered to vote because our city is 21,000 people, 67% of our city are African American. We all should be more representative in the political leadership of the city. We should be more representative in the law enforcement of our city. The young people are already turning to peaceful civic participation strategies. These are the kinds of conversations that we're having with folks, and we're going to do everything we can to support them by showing up on the ground, raising some resources to help them start and continue the work, so they can be able to have their own determination for how they want to live in their city and in their community.
One of the most frustrating things that I hear from others over and over is people who say, well, the president is black, so there can't be any more racism in our country. Now, I know what my answer to that attitude is, but I wish you'd tell me what your answer is and see if you can help me with that.
Well, I think that the president's race is a very important moment of triumph in our country in the sense that we have been able to elect an African-American to the highest office of the land. It cannot be reduced, and it should not be reduced. It should not be minimized. It has been a historic accomplishment that, given the racial history we have in our country, that someone from a minority population, historically oppressed people group, has been able to elevate to that level of election. At the same time, one election does not reverse 400 years of structural racism. People must realize that when we're talking about racism, we're not talking about a person. We're talking about a structure and a system of laws and of rules that are often embedded at the local, state, and federal level. And it has taken almost 400 years to make these laws, rules, structures, and systems codified. So what we need to be thinking about as we have the conversation about racism is not our individual people guilty of racism, because that's a no-win situation, I believe, a no-win conversation. I believe a win-win conversation is when we can talk about the structures that all of us participate in. How are they grinding people of color, poor people, to dust because of our economic policies, the way we are racially discriminating against folk around loans, around the sentencing laws, around the suspension rules in our classrooms. These are the structural questions that we must tackle, realizing that structures are made up of people. So then the personal responsibility is for us all to take a look at how we are participating either in maintaining the status quo of structural racism or dismantling the structural racism that is within our purview. And I think that the president has a responsibility to do this, but it is just not up to him. It is up to all of us. In that way, the election of the president is not the elimination of racism in our country. It is not the evidence that racism is over. As a matter of fact, it possibly could be the signal that now we actually have the power and the ability to eliminate the racism if we all do our work to address the structure.
I'm grateful for your wisdom, and to know that you're in the middle of all of this gives me a lot more confidence about the possibility of transitioning to something that may even have some very positive results. Pastor Mike McBride leads Lifelines to Healing, part of the PICO Network. You can learn more about the Live Free Sabbath at lifelinestohealing.org. Pastor Mike, thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio and for doing the work you're doing.
God bless you, my brother. We're ready to make this work, and we all got the work to do together. Always great to be with you.
Last month, the Arab American Institute released the findings of their latest poll of American attitudes toward Arabs and Muslims. Dr. James Zogby is president of the Arab American Institute, and I'm very happy to welcome him back on to State of Belief Radio today. Dr. Zogby, welcome.
Thank you very much, Walton.
Talk, if you will, about the attitudes that you've seen eroding over the past few years of doing this poll.
We tracked in our report the findings from 2010, 12, and 14, because in those three polls we started doing every other year, we'd ask a number of questions that were all the same, and therefore it allows us to do tracking of a number of issues. But in those 3 years, the favorable attitudes towards Arabs and Muslims have declined and the unfavorables have increased. But let me go back to when we first started doing questions about Arabs and Muslims in the early 90s. Back then, we found that attitudes towards Arabs and Muslims were roughly the same as attitudes towards Hindus and Chinese and Buddhists. They were 2-to-1 favorable, but the numbers were low. About 40% would say, I just don't know. Today, the numbers are significantly changed, more unfavorable than favorable. And of all the groups included in the survey, Arabs and in particular Muslims come out the lowest in favorable and highest in unfavorable ratings.
You know, Jim, it's impossible not to draw the conclusion that simply knowing Arab Americans and American Muslims makes a huge difference in attitudes toward members of those groups.
That's one of the issues that we've been tracking now in the last three surveys, and that's absolutely true. If you know an Arab or Muslim, your numbers are decidedly more favorable toward those two groups. I would also add that there's a huge demographic split. If you're younger, if you are educated, and if you are from a minority group, you are going to have, by and large, favorable attitudes. Older white guys are the issue.
What for me is a more difficult one, and that's the political polarization among the respondents. Is it unrealistic to draw a line from the media that members of the political parties are consuming and the conversations that they're having that's actually growing the levels of mistrust and negativity among conservatives? Because there is a tremendous divide.
People say, there's Fox News, there's CNN, there's MSNBC, and they cater to different crowds. they do cater to different crowds in an interesting way. People who are conservative, who call themselves conservative, will report largely watching Fox News. Fox News doesn't change people's opinions. It reinforces pre-existing positions, as does watching MSNBC reinforce the positions of people on the liberal side. And so if you have on the Fox News side a steady stream of people who are watching that and listening to talk radio shows that are largely right-wing talk radio shows, what you're going to get is a set of reinforced ideas that translates in the poll to when we ask people, do you know enough or do you need to know more? People who are Democrats and independents largely say, I don't know enough. I need to know more. So that even though their attitudes may not be very positive, although they're more positive than they are negative, they will say, I just don't know enough. I need to know more.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the Republican side, those who have negative attitudes towards Arabs, largely say, I know enough. I don't need to know anymore because I saw it on television or I heard it on the radio or I read it in some scandalous newspaper article about these people or those people or however they categorize them. So, yeah, there is a connection between the media that you watch, the attitudes you have, and the sense you have that I now know enough, I don't need to know anymore. All I want are my prejudices reinforced, which is what unfortunately occurs.
Jim, there's something profoundly sad about the answers you got regarding some Americans not trusting members of these groups as being able to put aside their primary loyalties to their religious or ethnic group in performing responsible duties. Isn't that a sign of a worrisome level of depersonalization?
Well, we've been asking that question now in the last three surveys, and what we have found, again, is an erosion of confidence in the ability of a person of Arab descent or a person of the Muslim faith to serve in an important government post. If you recall, in 2012, in one of the debates that occurred among the Republican presidential aspirant, Irman Gain said something to the effect that a Muslim who wanted a post in his government would have to take a special loyalty oath because he wouldn't trust him otherwise.
Right.
And they went down the line with the other candidates, and a total of five of them agreed that that ought to be the case. The only one who ducked it was Mitt Romney, and I think probably because he was a Mormon and understands the concerns of a minority who is held in suspicion, that he just wasn't going to go there. But that attitude became fairly widespread in the country, that Muslims were out to subvert the country. You had in the 2010 congressional race, 17 congressional races using very similar ads about Muslims and about the building of a mosque in Lower Manhattan, which was called a victory mosque. They're trying to take over the country and convert us to Islam. You had 27 states that were considering legislation banning Sharia law when there wasn't a single state where anyone was proposing Sharia law. This was an epidemic, like the kind of hysteria epidemics you read about, created by a non-event. I mean, it wasn't as if there were Muslims out there saying, let's introduce Sharia law and take over America. It didn't exist, yet 27 states were actually considering legislation to ban it. And that notion that you can't trust them, they're not public servants, they wouldn't be good Americans, of not only Muslims, but of Arab Americans, who are not Muslim for the most part, almost 70% of Arab Americans are Christian, ignores the reality that in the Bush administration itself, the head of the NIH was a Muslim American. He had Muslim Americans in the State Department. He had Arab Americans in his cabinet. He had Arab Americans in the National Security Council. And yet, as far as the Republican base was concerned, we don't trust those people to be Americans and to operate as Americans. And that was something quite worrisome to me and certainly to my community, is that if an Arab American were to get a post, then they would be held under suspicion by a large segment of the population and a majority of Republicans, which has been the case in some instances we've seen. That some folks in my community have had positions in government and have been hounded by some in Congress or others outside of Congress who felt that you couldn't have an Arab in a sensitive position in the State Department, an Arab American, you wouldn't trust them. That is not said about other ethnic or religious communities. It just isn't.
I am astounded at the level of simple misunderstanding that you found when it comes to America's not understanding the differences between Arabs and Muslims.
Yeah, I mean, they conflate the two. They believe that most Muslims are Arabs and most Arabs are Muslims, and both aren't true. About a third of Arab Americans, less than a third, are Muslim, and less than a quarter of Muslims are Arab.
Yeah.
And yet those stick together in people's minds, in large measure, because that's the way the negative stereotypes have been conveyed here.
Yeah. Will you talk about the implications of what you have been talking about here in your polling data, the implications of that for the way we live together?
America, what has always been its greatness, even if it hasn't lived up to its greatness, is the promise that we are one people, that we become one people. When people say to me, we need to inoculate ourselves against terrorism, I say, we already did. By becoming American. The fact that we take people from all over the world, they don't just get a passport, but they become a different person when they become American. You can be in Britain for three generations and still be tacky. You can be in Germany for three generations and still be a Turk. But in America, after you become an American, you become like everybody else, and no one can distinguish or should discriminate against you. And so if you want to say, what is different between us and Europe? It's that we have an absorptive identity, an identity that is all of us. Now, if we do not continue to operate that way, if we say to young Muslims and Arabs, you're not part of us, you'll never be part of us, then the danger of extremism will take root here because people will be alienated and not find a place in their American identity. And so to me, it is a very important issue that America live up to its promise and be American. I don't want to see young kids turn their back and feel America doesn't want me. It doesn't feel I belong here. And, you know, a lot of it, I think, goes to a lot of what we're seeing play out right now. And the changes are not the developments overseas, but it's the president we have, Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. I believe that anti-Muslim hysteria on the right wing is a function of their reaction against a black president that they still cannot live with. And so he's not like us, he's Muslim, he's not one of us, has spilled over into the public debate about a general intolerance for Arabs and Muslims, period. The seeds of it were there, but I think that part of the right-wing campaign against Barack Obama has been to fuel even greater sense of Islamophobia, and it is a travesty. So I think it has to do, at the end of the day, with our identity, with our ability to live up to our promise, with our ability to continue to absorb people and not alienate people, and it has to do with the image that we project to the world. Are we an open, tolerant, and inclusive society, or are we not? And so all of those reasons, to me, are important to consider every time we do one of these polls, and the findings that we get should challenge us to be better.
The American Attitudes Toward Arabs and Muslims poll has recently been released by the Arab American Institute. Dr. Zoghbi, thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio today.
Thank you.
In the last few weeks, there's been a marked increase in reports of anti-Semitic incidents in this country and around the world. The big question is, what can we do regarding expressions of bias and hatred right here at home? Joining me now is Rabbi Brad Hirschfeld, president of CLOWL, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. Brad, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Both in the U.S. and around the world, there's been a surge in reported incidents of anti-Semitism. What do you see this as an expression of?
It is very troubling. I do think it's important to note that the rise of incidents of hatred toward Jews, of anti-Semitism, is far greater around the world than it is here in the United States. And I don't say that to minimize it, but I think it's important that as we raise this important issue, we also not use it as an excuse to become panicked or to fail to recognize, with whatever faults we may think we have in this country, the remarkable openness to Jews, Judaism, and the Jewish community that remains a hallmark of American experience. And I'm deeply grateful for that. That doesn't mean I don't think we have to be vigilant. We have to be especially vigilant across the world where it's happening much worse. I think in the end, it's not altogether surprising. And while some, you know, will say that this is because of, as if that somehow excuses the war going on between Gaza and Israel, I think that actually it's related to it, but to imagine that lashing out at people simply because of who they are, be that because they are Jewish, which is what we're talking about, because they are black, which happens, because they are gay, and we know that happens, without knowing anything about them, what they've done, or what their beliefs are, that simply because they are, they become targets, is truly evil. And I don't say that about many things. And I think it's really important to distinguish between the anger we may feel at one particular group or another because of things that people in that group do, and simply hating them because they exist. And it's this second thing that I think you're asking about and that is particularly troubling. I think it has a lot to do with what this war is about. And ultimately, this war between Gaza and Israel, fundamentally, whatever opinion you have, each of us has to ask one question. Do we believe that a Jewish state of Israel has a right to exist anywhere in the Holy Land? I'm not talking about Bibi Netanyahu's Israel. I'm not talking about what's often called Greater Israel. I'm not talking about a right-wing Israel or a left-wing Israel. In the end, if one believes that there should be no Jewish state of Israel, then by all means, side with Hamas. And by all means, don't be surprised that your hatred isn't limited to Israel, but is directed to Jews in general. If one genuinely believes that a Jewish state has a right to exist in some portion, at least, of the state of Israel, then actually there is no room for lashing out at Jews in general, or even for failing to support Israel in this war. That does not mean there isn't room for criticism. It just means there's only one fundamental question that has to be answered, and then after that we can work everything else out.
Brad, I often think about this because I know you and I know your colleagues and the people with whom you work all the time. When we talk about anti-Semitism, how do you and your closest colleagues talk about this? Is it an ongoing concern? How deep is the concern? I'd just like to listen in on your conversation sometime to find that out.
It's a great question, Welton, and I would tell you that like any family table conversation, there are a lot of different opinions. And there isn't going to be total agreement. And I'll say something else. I find over time that there is value to having opinions at the table, including the ones I really don't agree with.
Yeah.
So there are certainly people, I'm being very candid, I am not among them, that wake up most days worrying about Jew hatred in America. It's not that I don't think it doesn't exist. But I think that to spend one's time devoting that much energy to something that is not nearly as prevalent as it once was and only seems to be on the decline, in part because of the vigilance, is allowing not only the tail to wag the dog, but to miss all the really great stuff that is going on. So I think that if I were to summarize what goes on in the community as a whole, you have from people who think, you know, around every corner there's a Jew hater, to people who think there's nothing at all to worry about. I am certainly closer to the second category, but history reminds me that to be fully in that category is to be naive. So my advice is one should be vigilant about any form of bias and hatred. But if your attentiveness to hatred toward any group becomes so dominant that it gets in the way of celebrating what the group is able to accomplish, mm-hmm. what benefits accrue to being a part of that group. In other words, if worrying about the bad stuff mm-hmm. undermines your ability to appreciate the good stuff, mm-hmm. you're probably worrying too much. There is a serious problem of Jew hatred in European capitals.
Mm-hmm.
When doctors can hang up signs, as they have done in some of the Benelux nations, saying they will not treat Jews, we have a problem. When leading intellectuals, as one did in Italy, said the most horrific things about Jews simply because they are Jewish, we have a problem. But that doesn't mean that Jews in Washington, New York, or Atlanta, or Tuscaloosa are under threat. Mm-hmm. There is a difference between New York and Washington and Atlanta and Tuscaloosa and London and Paris and Rome. In the same way, the fact that Christians are under assault in large parts of Iraq does not mean that Muslims in America want to hurt Christians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's really important to be able to be attentive to the hot spots in the world and to respond to them with real activism when necessary, without conflating the situation over there with the situation over here.
I would like to think that part of the reason for that is the work that various faith leaders have done in dealing with their tradition and its relationship to other traditions in this land. But I would like for you to talk about that, the contribution that faith leaders have and can still make that help us be who we are.
I think there is no way, frankly, to overestimate the importance of what you're describing. It is precisely when people who are members of specific faith communities hear from their own leaders that the dignity and respect we show other faiths is itself a fulfillment of the best teachings of our own particular faith that we do best.
Mm-hmm.
It's very nice when people who aren't particularly invested in any one tradition say, you should all be nice to each other, all you faithy folk.
Yeah.
And I know they're sincere and they mean well. It's just not terribly helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But when someone who says, I have staked my life and my soul on this particular tradition, and at its core, it demands that we, the followers of this tradition, show respect and appreciate the dignity of those who do not follow our tradition. That's where the real breakthroughs are made.
Yeah. I think some people are of the opinion that when we faith leaders get together, that we sit around and we talk about how much we ought to love each other and how much we ought to be serving each other and all that, when really what is most helpful in what we're talking about here is getting in front of us on the table where we disagree and how we can disagree best without hurting all of the traditions at the table.
Yeah, that is the key, right? Where we agree, frankly, at the risk of sounding curmudgeonly, is boring because we already agree.
Yeah.
What we're going to need to do, and I do believe that the faithful in America are the best positioned people on the planet to do this,
mm-hmm.
is to figure out how to mobilize our faiths at precisely the moments of disagreement and demonstrate that we can disagree with each other without going to war against each other.
Yeah.
And that's the test. I'm a big boy. I get it. We have certain luxuries in this country that they don't have in other countries. And in the short term, anyway, there probably will be some wars. But I'll tell you what, it would be great to see people understand how within their own given tradition, just because a fight is sacred or a disagreement is about the will of God, it doesn't always have to demand violence.
Yeah.
There are other ways to work these things out, at least the first go-around or the second go-around. So I don't want to be naive. There may be more fights coming. I'm sure there are, in fact. But it would be great if the first response when we have a sacred disagreement was to look to each other and not to the sight of a weapon.
How is it possible that all of us have not learned the lessons of history about bias-based faith?
Well, I think there are a couple things, and at the risk of sounding Pollyannish, I actually think things are moving in the right direction. I think as crazy as the world is at some moments, if you compare it to the world of 70, 80, 100, 150 years ago, we're actually doing better. And some of the reason we forget that is we know a lot more than our grandparents and great-grandparents did. But in fact, if you look at the statistics, on balance, we are moving in the right direction. There are more categories that we afford human dignity to than we used to. Right? We talked before about anti-Semitism, just to start there. In my grandparents' generation, the image of someone who hated Jews was often as likely to be as not an upper-class, Ivy League-educated person of privilege and power.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this country, the average person who hates Jews is likely to be an under- and miseducated person living at or below the poverty line with little power whatsoever. It doesn't make their hatred okay, but that's a big shift when those who hate used to be at the top of society and now are not. So things are getting better. They're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think that they are getting better. Beyond that, I think, how do we accelerate that process? We're going to have to start teaching people that whatever commitments they have, political, especially religious, if you find yourself justifying that commitment based on what's wrong with everyone else, as opposed to why you simply love being how you are, you're probably not helping anyone, including yourself. But if you can build your commitments based on a genuine sense of, I love being this way, here's how being this way, be it Christian or Muslim or Jewish or Buddhist or atheist, here's how it helps me to lead a happier, more ethical life and inspires me to help others do the same, we may not agree, but my guess is we'll all be on the right track.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfeld is president of CLOW, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership in New York City. Brad, it's a difficult subject. You've handled it, as you always do, in a very helpful, thorough way. You always remind me of the good. And that's really helpful, and I thank you.
Well, I appreciate that a lot. Thank you. It's a pleasure. Be well.
Before we go, the sad news of the death of actor and comedian Robin Williams this past Monday reverberated around the world. Judging by social media, everybody has a favorite Williams movie quote or impression. Also, judging by social media, quite a few people had an instant opinion to share about the reason for and meaning of the 63-year-old performer's suicide. I once had the privilege of interviewing Robin regarding his association with Walter Cronkite. Yes, Robin was a funny man professionally, but he also was a serious thinker who cared about the same life issues that most of us care about. I grieve because of his death, but I have to be honest with you, my grief transitions quickly into anger when I hear individuals insensitive to the horrors of mental illness, unaware of the dynamics of depression, and eager to turn human tragedy into an opportunity for partisan political slander. Sorrow is deep and disturbing enough, friends, without the dramatic demonstrations of ignorance that result in an incredibly judgmental style of thinking and an offensive arrogance. Robin Williams' family has requested privacy in which to grieve. Understandable. But you know, perhaps it is time for all of us to be quiet and to rethink the fragility of life, the unknown depths of misery in people who seem all right, and the need for more respect when it comes to issues of life and death. Robin Williams died way too early. But Robin, thanks for the artistry, and thanks for the life, and thanks for the laughs. Rest in peace, good friend. Rest in peace. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support is essential in helping to make this show possible. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today, right now, as a matter of fact. We'll use your money wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. Every week, we hear from listeners across the country who say they rely on our show for the kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue that they simply cannot find anywhere else. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show. Hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. Stay in touch with us, please. You can do that throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. Our listener line is 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen so that we can keep on broadening the conversation and thus expanding the knowledge of all of us. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. It's been a tough week. Until next week, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what?